come into our board session here. County Council, could you give us a report, please, out of closed session?
We went into closed session at 8:35. We came out at 9 o'clock. There's no reportable action.
Thank you. Invocation, chapter. They see me needed today.
And that's general, just on top of it.
Father, we're grateful for the blessings in our life. We look around us, we see the beauty of your creation. And we come together here today as the board and the staff of the county. We are so appreciative of their work and all that they do. We know that there are times when there are struggles, but we pray that all decisions and commitments are made from a heart of caring, from a position of integrity. For all those who have things to say, we know that it's important to them. We're grateful that we have public participation. And we just desire all to come to a place of agreement. We know there are many challenges. Give them strength to face each challenge every day. We just give you thanks for all good things. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.
Thank you, Chaplain. Okay, we're going to move on to presentations from the public. This time slot is for information from the public. No action or discussion will be conducted on matters presented at this time. You'll be allowed 3 minutes, and I want to re-emphasize 3 minutes, please. It's not fair for people to go beyond, because then I'd have to do it for everyone. So I'm going to try to hold you to that. And I guess when we get to a point where a couple seconds beyond is not, is still within the realm of okay. Chair can extend the time for 5 minutes, but that won't happen today. When comments can be made, presented to desired by providing 7 copies to the board. So if you have correspondence or something, please present that to the clerk. Comments should be limited to matters within the jurisdiction of the board. Our first public comment is going to be Jay Martin.
Good morning, Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors. My name is Jay Martin. I am with Siskiyou News. I am an independent news source in Siskiyou County. I have taken over what Danny Webster had. I've been, in capacity for coming up on a year now. I've been watching, listening, trying to build a voice for you, build a voice for Siskiyou County residents, to where we could try to get a little bit of more information from everybody and have it in a more cohesive, consistent manner. The ability nowadays to physically have a newspaper it's not doable in my capacity. So social and digital format is where we're at. I have a pretty good presence in Siskiyou County. I see a lot of issues when I read through what's going on with rules, things that have been done. Real good examples, we have so many big issues, and it's hard to, you just can't tackle everything, it's not that easy. But when I look at things like marijuana, where you say you have it's illegal for a commercial operation, but where's the enforcement? You have to enable people to be able to enforce what you put in place. Homelessness is another big thing that we see as people are going past I-5. They see that on a hill. Maybe there could be different directions. It is, we're bound, but there is alternatives. And we need to kind of address a lot of different things. Water. Dams. What I see and that I want to be the platform for without me being a direction. I am gray. I want black and white to come in and try to figure out where the gray fits. And that's where residents of Siskiyou County, we like to use our vote. And in our capacity, our vote is very small. But other people are using their voice. And we need to start using our voice. Because our voice is what can push things forward. It's our voice that needs to be heard. Because they're not listening to our vote.
Thank you. Caleb Burns.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Not something that I would normally do here, but I represent a local company in the town of Mount Shasta, a guiding outfitter company, and there's a lot of businesses down there that have been struggling this year, and it's just something I wanted to bring to your attention regarding the closure of Everett Memorial Highway and the Castle Lake Road access. I completely understand the need to have that road closed at periods, especially when we have heavy snow loads, things like that. But it's really important to us and that local community that you understand the impacts of that. You know, I only represent a small dining service there in town, but there's restaurants, there's hotels, there's other businesses that were struggling, especially in a year like this where we had an amazing snow year. People that will go there to get to the mountain, which is really why that community is there and why we thrive for so long, is because of that recreational access. When you don't have that access available anymore, people don't just go to the ski resort. It's a completely different clientele, and we're losing tax money and revenue and business income, which ultimately makes things more difficult financially for everybody there. You know, that mountain's important to the community for a lot of reasons. We draw people as an outfitter. We draw people from all over the world to actually climb that peak. So it's a huge impact beyond the local community as far as financially. We bring a lot of money in from that mountain. And when we have a really good winter like this, you know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars between all those businesses combined, from hotel stays, restaurants, our guide services, tax dollars, revenue that comes into the county. And I don't know the exact solution for the problem right now, and I'm not here to present one. I'm just hopeful that we can come up with some sort of future solution to it that is sustainable, that, you know, is equitable for all the businesses there, so that we can continue to thrive in the way that, you know, we should be able to with that access and bring more people into that community, so that ultimately the community can have more money and we can actually, you know, show people a good time and really why this place is so special. When we don't have that access available, it's really difficult to do that. You know, we, as an outfitter, we had to get really kind of creative, and we're having to send people to other places that we operate, which takes money away from this area. So, you know, I'm not here to jump up and down and say, you know, please do this, but I think that it's important that you guys know that there was a petition that started. Currently, it's over 400 signatures. You know, about some sort of solution, just to bring it to your attention that it's a problem, and it's one that the community members are aware of, but there's also signatures from outside the area on that petition, because, like I say, we bring people in from all over the world to do that. So I hope that we can come up with a solution that will be fair for everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. I would ask that you reach out to me at some point. It's my district, but, you know, I get this all the time. The board is fully aware of the importance. I would tell you the beneficiary is not the county, it's the city. They do not contribute to plowing that road. I will tell you, this year we've spent in excess of $300,000 to plow Everett Memorial and Castle Lake out of our general, or out of the public works department. We bought a new rotary snow plow. It's up there operating now. We had a bad year, and this year drove, we have to do something. So we got new equipment. There's a plan in place, and we're moving forward. So you'll see improvement.
And I would love to work closer, and I know that a lot of businesses there would love to work closer with the supervisors too.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would just comment that when that access is open, it's open for everyone, and not just a certain segment of recreation.
Yes.
Because I know there's been conflict up there between the recreational use and snowmobilers, and that's not fair.
No, not
especially
at all.
When we're talking about the overall economy.
Yeah, no, I completely 100% agree. I can say from my business standpoint, we welcome snowmobilers, even though we are on non-mechanized access there.
As long as everyone has that.
Yeah, it should be open to sledders, families that are there to enjoy it, as well as
climbers. Parking's always been an issue up there, so dealing with the Forest Service. So let's touch bases. We need to discuss more.
Thank you for opening that communication.
Okay, the rest of the comments are for a specific item, so we'll wait for that. Anything online, please, that is a general comment.
Caller ending in 1697, it's your turn to speak.
Can you put the names up there, please?
Boundary 100, Heflin.
I'm online, I think I'm on the conference call. Is it my turn?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. Hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, we can.
I prepared this and timed it by 3 minutes. My name is Evan Churchill. I'm a citizen. I'm right over across from the courthouse on 208 South Street. I want to make you aware of a problem unfolding in the Shasta Valley that's soon end up in the county's lap because unsustainable fraud has affected many of our county citizens. In a few short years, a rogue $160,000 a year special district general manager in Lake Shastina has simultaneously taken $24 million and thousands of lot owners while claiming it didn't impact them, and then more than doubling salary and personnel expense from $900,000 to over $2 million for the special district that just had taken the $24 million. This was done by placing a special assessment of an $8,000 fee on all lots not yet with a home on. Then, once he cleaned the slate, instead of taking new financially prudent steps to avoid the buildup of more unpaid sewer and water infrastructure, he then rapidly doubled salary and personnel expense at the district. We can't let this happen in our backyard, where citizens that include many vulnerable elderly got hit by $8,000 each without a vote. This corruption cost them more than the city of Bell, cost each of its citizens in that famous scandal, and those officials went to jail. Does anybody on this board think it is reasonable to buy a lot for $5,000 with an $8,000 hookup fee, the pipe already on the property? I believe that this is the type of corrupt nonsense the county did not want when it set up the charter for the special district in the 1970s to be sure they provide the needed services. This form of financial engineering has cost $13,000 a lot and would be appraised for $5,000 and no longer sell. This was done while CSC officials fraudulently claim, and they do today in right, the citizens that it won't affect current ratepayers. Preposterous. Can't surround 1,000 lots with 3,000 lots that are upside down and tell them it doesn't affect theirs. It's required to be disclosed in California for sales and appraisals. That is, by nature, the definition of fraud. To add insult to injury, the GM has taken their district personnel expense from $900,000 over $2 million in a few short years as a follow-up to this lot banking exercise. This ramped-up, unprofessional group are staffing task forces that pull folks over on Highway 5 and take over sheriff activity in CHP territory outside their special district, while bankrupting the special district where they're supposed to serve to pay for it. What's going on here? DM brags to citizens that the county supports all of these efforts. I can't believe the county thinks this is okay. The special district, Little Shastina, now has nearly 10 folks that cost citizens in excess of $100,000 per year each. This while last week they tried to claim only two personnel cost us over $100,000 in writing to the citizens.
Okay.
State control would clear that one up real fast.
All right.
But they were caught again purveying false info to citizens.
Okay, your 3 minutes are up. So, excuse me.
Can we get his last name?
Could we just give us your last name, please?
I'm almost done.
Could you give us your last name, please?
My what?
Your last name?
Churchkov.
Okay, I would suggest you send us some written comments so we can follow up on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Anyone else online for public comment, in general comment?
Showing no others online.
Okay, we'll move on to our consent agenda, item 7. Anything from the board?
I'd like to pull one.
Randy?
If we could pull item 7B, as in boy.
7B as in boy.
Thank you.
There's
7A. 7A from Mr. Weatheroga. Anyone else?
I would... Go ahead. I would move for the ballots.
A second.
All righty. Supervisor Hall?
Aye.
Supervisor Kopsev?
Aye.
Supervisor Chris?
Aye.
Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
And Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yes, item 7A.
7A. Holy smoke.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring this to everybody's attention. This program is something that is really good for our community. And I just thought that Mr. Dean could speak to this just a little bit and let us know what this program is all about.
Okay, happy to. Thank you very much. It's kind of a bright spot for change. The wood smoke program initially was started with air pollution control back in the day, and they were running out of funding. So we were approached by Supervisor Alan Squayla to see if we could come up with CDBG funding to infuse that program. That was not possible due to the constraints of housing and community development. So what had happened is basically we ended up taking that program over, and Kristen Lackey here has done a fabulous job moving that forward. And many, many kudos to you.
Thank you.
Frankly, it's been a heavy lift. I pop into the office there and look at some of these packets that she has to deal with, and they are literally this thick to install a single wood stove to improve our environment. Mm-hmm. And each and every one has to go through the NEPA process. It's just mind-boggling, quite frankly, what it does to kind of help things out, the process. So I'm going to turn this over to Kristen here to talk about details and advertising and so forth in the program.
Good morning, Chair and members of the board. As Rick alluded to, it's community development block grant funds that are from HUD, and then they come to us through the state. So we have layers of regulations from the state and the feds, which does make it so difficult and a little bit more costly to do than the Air Pollution Control Board's program. So with the amount of funds that we have, we can do about 30 stove swap outs, and we've had 32 applicants so far. Lots of phone calls too. Unfortunately, the program can only be run in the unincorporated areas of the county and for homeowners only. So a lot of the time when people call, they end up ultimately not being able to apply because we get a lot of city calls. 13 applications have either been denied or dropped. Again, it, you know, people will turn in their application, and then we look, and either the property taxes aren't paid, that's another rule of the program, or they don't income qualify because we have a cap on the amount of income that a household can earn in order to participate in the program. And some people decided to drop because they don't want government in their house. I've gotten that a couple of times. Or, you know, they felt like it was an invasion of privacy to get their income information, because we do have to ask for personal information. We have 10 in process. As Rick noted earlier, we have to do income verification, we have to do a NEPA review, Holy Smokes needs to go out and do the initial inspection, then they go out and do the work, and then it's a formal building permit process. And sometimes that involves, if it's a manufactured home, it has to go back to the state. They're in charge of the permit. So that does take a lot of time. So far we have 9 installed. And then we also just did some new marketing about a month ago, because we started getting low on people on the list. And we've had a lot of interest. As a result of that, I just, you know, made new flyers, sent them out to all the community resource centers. I did a press release that was on the county website. We put it on the planning Facebook page, and then it went on the grapevine, and I think we got a lot of interest from that. We also get a lot from Great Northern. People that call there for their weatherization program, they will refer them to us if it seems like it's a good fit. Also, Holy Smoke is also participating when they have people that come in that they have a problem with their wood stove or they need something. they have flyers up there and they let them know about the program. So we get a lot of people that way. But my phone has been ringing a lot. And we're at the point actually now with these, we have 9 new applications coming in that we're probably getting close to that 30. So I don't want to over-advertise and then have to tell people that they can't participate in the program. So it seems like the marketing that we just did was just enough to get us to the number we need to be at. With that, did you have any more questions?
No, I think it's great news, and it's something that's a real positive thing for our community. And that was my biggest question was, you know, why the increase in funds? And you've answered my questions. And also, if you're doing advertising to let the community know that this program is available, and again, you've answered my questions. So thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation.
Well, our new reporter could help on the advertising.
I know, I thought about that
so,
earlier.
Rick, I can't thank you enough. You know how important this has been to me. You know, this really goes to our underserved community, particularly our senior citizens. You know, I'm glad there's criteria. It's unfortunate, it's too much bureaucracy to do it. When and where I can, I will pass that information along to the powers that be when I'm down at the Capitol, so to speak. Yeah. And I appreciate all the effort because this, you know, replacing wood stoves that are, you know, fire danger, quite honestly. You know, so if we can prevent a fire, that's doing everything. So thank you for all the hard work and effort. And I know this has always been oversold. And then there was state money, and then they took that money's gone away. So we've reinvented it. So 30 doesn't sound like a lot, but in the end, over years, it will add up. So thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you for pulling that out of this question. Anyone else? Michael?
No.
Okay, 7B.
Motion.
Oh, okay.
I move to approve.
Second.
Okay. Supervisor Hupp?
Aye.
Supervisor Popsa?
Aye.
Supervisor Chris?
Aye.
Supervisor Ogre?
Aye.
And Supervisor Valenzuela?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
7B.
And 7B, it sounds like it was continued to this board meeting, but they're still working on it. So if we could officially drop it from the agenda, I'd appreciate it. Because it will be coming back in another form.
Okay, that's a motion by Wendy. All in favor?
Thank you. If you tell me it's dropped, it's
dropped. It's dropped.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on to item 8A. County Clerk.
Me again. All righty, so this is the first reading of a proposed ordinance to amend Title II, Chapter 12, Section 2-12.101 of the Siskiyou County Code regarding county clerk's fees, and this is to increase the amount of a confidential marriage license from $78 to $79. This is a $1 state fee. That already needs to be collected. It's just making our ordinance match the state numbers. If we could approve that and have a second reading on May 16th, I'd appreciate it.
Move to approve.
Alrighty. And that's with the May 16th date as well?
Sure.
Thank you much. Oh, thank you. Sorry, I didn't hear you. All righty. Supervisor Hupp?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobbsep?
Aye.
Supervisor Chris?
Aye.
Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
And Supervisor Valenzuela? Thank you.
Item 8B, probation. We're here to get an update on current operations and activities. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity. I'm Michael Coley. I'm Chief Probation Officer for the Siskiyou County Probation Department. And before I introduce the person here with me, I would like to share something with you. If you recall, back in March, we announced the retirement of the Assistant Chief Probation Officer. And we held an active recruitment. And as part of that extensive interview process, I'd like to announce that Ms. Stacy Jackson has been appointed the Assistant Chief for the probation department. So.
Congratulations. Thank you.
I love promoting from within.
Yeah. So Assistant Chief Jackson and I, along with 32 very talented community corrections professionals, make up the probation department. We're a collective group of talented individuals who perform a variety of tasks that make the department successful today. For example, we have the probation officer. This position encompasses a social worker, a peace officer, and someone who understands how to write comprehensive reports for the court. This position also supervises justice-involved individuals, conducts and interprets the assessments, and makes the appropriate referrals to our collaborative partners. Another position in our department is the crime analyst. This person is responsible for creating reports based on the data they collect. These reports can be simple, showing current drug trends, or complicated reports, such as localized assessment of tool validation. The analyst is responsible for analyzing data that determines how successful we are at effecting change. This is important because rehabilitation is at the forefront of our mission. The analyst report allows us the opportunity to see if the program we are doing is worth continuing or if we should stop it. This position not only important to the lives we try to change, but is also important to the efficiency of our department. I don't assist, Chief. Do you have anything to add?
I do. So as Mike mentioned, as we gather that data, we apply it and utilize our evidence-based practices. So decades of research have proven that an evidence-based assessment and case planning model is proven to have those cognitive behavioral interventions, and they help us refer to other agencies in a better way and more accurately. This enhances the outcomes not only for our clients, those justice-involved individuals and their families, but also the community and officer safety. Evidence-based practices include constant evaluation and validation of those practices to make sure that the interventions actually work on a scale that is appropriate, beneficial, and important to all of us, very cost-effective. If a program is not working and it's not affecting change or helping anyone out, and the data shows that, it should be evaluated and something else should be put into its place rather than throw money after something that's not working, right? That's important to us all. So research indicates that those individuals that are low risk should not be included in high-risk programming because it doesn't work and in fact can make things worse. Again, rehabilitation is at the forefront of our mission and our goal for our clients.
Thank you. So I'll talk about some recent changes in operations as a result of legislation. So first, we have the pretrial monitoring program. It should be noted that the probation department has been performing pretrial services since 2015. However, in 2018, SB 10 was passed, which focused on the monetary bail system and the use of risk assessment tools. But it wasn't until SB 129 passed in 2021 that shifted the responsibility to the court and mandated that this process be part of it. So we support the court by writing pretrial reports and performing limited case management for those deemed eligible. The risk assessment used in this particular case only determines the likelihood of that person returning back to the next court appointment. It doesn't involve any type of risk for recidivism or committing a new crime. Part of the evidence-based process is validating the tool or assessment using your local data. This is important because it shows whether or not a specific tool works. For a small county like ours, collecting some of that data and validating tools often proves to be difficult, but our analyst has done a great job. Matter of fact, they've established data as far back as 1992 and incorporated it. But with their assistance, we were able to validate our local tool, and this is something that when we write our reports to the state, they ask whether or not your local tool is validated, and we're happy to say that we have. So it's a good step for our department. The pretrial program is not probation. It's just a program deemed for persons deemed eligible to be released from custody and to return at a later time to show up for their court process. And as a result of their release, they're required to follow certain conditions of the court, which could include pretrial monitoring. We do drug testing. We can provide housing services for these folks, but they're not under the supervision of the probation department. And we wrote 261 pretrial reports in 2021. I'll ask Stacy if she has anything she'd like to add.
So just with that, again, a lot of people think that someone who is justice involved is on probation or on parole. And to be clear, pretrial is not a condition or there's no parole or probation involved. However, it does afford the ability for us to refer to other agencies and support that person in between the arraignment and the actual future court dates. So that information that we give to the court is really important. again, back to those basic needs that humans have for housing, medical care, food, and we can support that person and make sure, attempt to make sure that they come back for court at the appropriate time.
Thank you. Next, another important topic and something that's been around for the Siskiyou County for a while is the Day Reporting Center, or otherwise known as the DRC. It was originally conceptualized by the Community Corrections Partnership. This collaboration led to the development of several different programs that were designed to complement our efforts at reducing recidivism. So prior to the pandemic, there was a woodworking program, a garden, an animal program, and a firewood distribution program. And since COVID set in, some of those programs had gone away due to the constraints of, just the nature of the pandemic. But each, you know, we shared an assignment by most of our local county departments, and each one contributed something to the betterment of the program. The only programs that remained through the pandemic were the Sheriff's SWAT program and the Cognitive Behavioral Therapy program. Both were vital to the success in rehabilitation and accountability. Again, of course, our partners at Helping Human Service continue to provide mental health support in substance abuse disorder classes. So in 2020, there was 3,628 hours of important evidence-based treatment groups. In 2021, we saw a significant increase to 5,342 hours. Combined, we had 97 justice-involved individuals who participated in their case plans created by the probation officer or as a mandate from the court. Other services carried out during 2020 and 2021 were a GD, or Diploma Assistance Class, job readiness class, and vocational training opportunities. And this was all while the pandemic was happening. We were still providing these additional services. We also assisted several individuals in obtaining their driver's license. Rest assured, no training was done in the county vehicles. We made sure. This was strictly done using the California DMV handbook, facilitated by our credentialed staff. We have one staff member that has a teaching credential, and we were able to apply that. But these programs play an important role for reducing barriers to success. So another highly successful program and a great opportunity for our county was the Forestry Check program. This program was developed through a collaboration with Dunsmuir Adult Education, Black Fox Timber Management Group, and the Probation Department. Although unannounced, a representative from Congressman LaMalfa's office was there earlier this month presenting certificates to the graduates of that program. So as I mentioned, the pandemic had an impact on services at the DRC. However, with the recent addition of a program coordinator, we are hoping to rebuild a robust program that provides critical components that will serve positive outcomes with the populations we serve. This position is responsible for monitoring, developing, and guiding our county by assessing the needs of justice involved and by making sure we are on track to reducing recidivism. And I'm turning to Stacey.
Yeah, just a few things to point out. In the DRC, we have the cognitive behavioral therapy courses that we do, but also we have a provider who helps people get their high school diplomas, vocational skills, but also soft skills, how to interview, how to fill out job applications, how to fill out rental things. And those things, again, getting back to those basic needs that people have. If you don't know how to fill out the application for a job or for power, then you struggle. So we're trying to overcome those barriers. The other thing I wanted to mention about our forestry tech program is there were 12 people in the class. Four of those last year were justice involved. They were probation involved people. This year we had three graduate. And those people are, it's no guarantee ever in life, but I know they've all had at least two interviews for jobs in the forestry industry, and it's really exciting to see them be successful.
Thank you, Stacey. Mm-hmm. So finally, we'll talk a little bit about the swing in youth incarceration. It's been an important topic of light with the recent legislation. So SB 823 passed in September of 2021. This bill was aimed at closing down the Division of Juvenile Justice and shift that responsibility to the counties. A plan was brought before the Board of Supervisors in August of 21, detailing our county's approach to this legislative change. So fast forward to December 22nd, we had one youth that was housed at DJJ, and we started looking at what those options were for this. They were going to be released at the closure of DJJ. So through a thoughtful process, a collaborative process involving the court, the probation departments, and the attorneys involved. A plan was developed and that would allow us to meet the needs of this legislative change. This youth plan was put into place, and the alternative requirements of the program look at a lesser means of restriction. So this person was placed on parole. His current plan allowed him to relocate to another county, which were then we were able to successfully transfer that case to that community. We no longer have any youth at DJJ, and we don't have to do any more preparation for that closure. So based on, so we no longer have any, DJJ is slated to close on June 30th of 2023. And as part of the change, the probation department has placed one youth in the secure youth treatment. That's the new step on the new program. So a secure youth treatment facility program. So prior to this legislative change, this youth might have served their time at DJJ. However, our relationship with the Probation County Collaborative Consortium options were developed. So the Probation County Collaboration Consortium was created to ensure high quality treatment programs for any youth in California. Absent AB, SB 823 would have been committed to DJJ. So that's the consortium that basically pulled the state of California the available options of severe incarceration, high-risk youth to lesser means, even camps. So we continue to contract with both Tehama and Shasta County for detention needs, and both of those also offer the secure youth as well as less restrictive alternatives. So we'll still have those available options. We've seen that the trend, it's a lot less. Youth are being sent to the secure youth track. They're trying to divert that before it gets there, which is a good sign. And several years ago, there used to be quite a few youth that would have been sentenced to adult court. We're also seeing a trend that that's even going away or diminished, so which is positive. So I don't know if Stacey has anything.
So just a few more things about the secure youth track. That has become more focused on the youth and rehabilitation that includes the family members, and the probation department meets with that youth at least once a month, which is something we did not do with youth at DJJ. Right now, Tehama County is where we have our secure youth person, and they have a case manager that meets with that youth, and they develop a case plan, they talk about future. They have offerings for both woodworking, metal, welding, and they do gardening, and they can earn a culinary certificate, like they're safe food handlers, and move forward in a lot of different avenues. So when that youth does return to our community, they're closer in proximity. They're not down in Ventura. They're not down in Stockton anymore. They're closer, so that family reunification piece can be emphasized. And they come out with some school credits. They come out with some certificates. And it's a process of a step down versus just staying at DJJ until you're done. They'll come out maybe on ankle monitor and be at home for a while, and then that's reduced. So it's a good process. It's a good thing for our youth. We have detained far fewer youth now than we have in past years, and I think it's going to be a great collaboration, and Tehama's done a good job of setting up their program. So
So we hope you found this information beneficial. Our annual 2022 report should be out soon. I'll make sure that you have that. There's a lot of really good data information that breaks down a lot of the operations of the probation department, as well as the day reporting center, the pretrial program, and some of those things I discussed in here. And again, it's a very comprehensive report with a lot of data. I would encourage you to review that, and please reach out if you have any questions. At this point, I'd like to answer any questions you may have.
Let's see if there's any from the board. Anyone?
Yes, so what's the staffing level percentage-wise? I know there's one vacancy that's created because something was filled, but how are you looking percentage-wise for the probation officers?
So as a department, as a total, we have 34 positions, and currently there's only three vacancies. We have two, so we're almost a really full department. We're very happy and excited, so thank you for asking. Yes, we're almost at full capacity, and I anticipate by the end of summer, we'll have hopefully full staff.
That's a big accomplishment in the current environment we're in. It's hard to hire people, so that's a wonderful accomplishment.
Yeah, we've been very fortunate to find some really good qualified staff.
If I could just add, we should thank the CAO's office for that. Their personnel staff has just really been attentive, and Becky's our person that we work with, and it's been a really good relationship, and they do such a good job. I just want to make sure they're included in that accommodation.
And then as a further compliment to your department, a few years ago there was a house fire in McDowell, and some of your crew members showed up and were pulling hose and helping out.
Yeah, we get involved. We have multifaceted folks and very talented. Yeah. So thank you for acknowledging that.
Can you expand upon the youth part for the secure youth? What classification puts a youth in that higher category? I appreciate the rehabilitation, but there also needs to be consequence to bad conduct, and we're seeing more and more of that nationwide. And I mean, we're not, how do I say, coddling youth, you know, just saying be better, but can you expand upon, you know, how we're helping them to be better, and what gets them into that high category, into the secure youth?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So your high felonies, so your crimes against persons, crimes against the state, so those crimes that would consider, you know, let's say a prison commitment. So DJJ was the equivalent to prison as at the adult level, but for the youth. So that would be, you know, it could be, but it has to be a severe felony that qualifies that youth to be eligible for the secure track. So again, using evidence-based practices, scientific research, they're showing that just the hard incarceration isn't doing enough to change a person, the affecting change. So, you know, I can't say to how far they've reached to coddle, as you say, and I think, you know, time will tell what that data will show. But that landscape is changing. I don't know if you've recently read, but LA is going through a lot of issues with their juvenile halls, and we're very fortunate not to have what they're experiencing. But again, it's going to take time for the data to show. I don't know if whether what we're doing today is going to work, but a lot of cognitive-based therapies, that approach, that building case plans, reintegration of the community, all those things to make a person successful. So they're not just in custody doing nothing. They're actually programming and hopefully considering changing their lives for the better. So, but when they get out, they have the opportunity to be successful as well. Because a lot of times you'll find it's just usually cut off. They were inside, incarcerated, then just released with no supports. So they're really developing the support system, and that's where the biggest component of the secure youth track is.
So there used to be a program out, maybe still out there, and I'm maybe calling it by the wrong name, but it basically had to do with restitution, where whatever the crime was, they would have to go to whoever they committed the crime against to actually confront that. Is that program? Say it.
Restorative justice programs, yes.
Is that something that we embrace here, or is that program even still out there?
So it's it is out there. I see it, in fact, probably coming back. We do want to recognize and repair the victim as well. Mm-hmm. They've been removed from the spotlight, if you would, for so long, and there just seems to be a need to make sure that the victim is whole again as well, and restorative programs are.
Well, that also, from my understanding, benefits the one that did whatever it was against the victim. That's the whole purpose of it as well, correct?
Absolutely, okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I look forward to seeing that come to Siskiyou when that can happen.
We'll look into it, for sure. We have to find collaboration with the courts, but I'm sure that wouldn't be an issue. They're very responsive and very open. As well, if you see that the Veterans Court, Mental Health Courts, and the other drug court as well. So,
thank you.
Very popular. Thank you.
Supervisor?
Yeah, I just appreciate everything your department does and how thorough you are in your communication to us. And you including me, especially in all your events, I really enjoy being a part of the things that you and your department do for our community. The things that draw your people in and the work that you do is amazing. And it keeps not only the community engaged and your clients engaged and moving forward, but also your own department. And I see the joy in their work and the commitment that they have, and that shows in that you have a full department. And I really do appreciate the work that you do, so thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. I'm sure to relay that comment. We often find ourselves just so inundated and buried in work, we don't stop to really do that self-care kind of thing. So I'm sure this will be very good news to the staff. So thank you.
Supervisor Hawk, anything? Congratulations, Ms. Jackson.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So just real quick, yes. I don't need a quick response, but, you know, it seems to me probation is more on the reactionary side. Can you, do you have any thoughts about what you can do on the front-end sides? Front-end?
With that being said, so we form different roles. Again, we're the social worker, the therapist, and we're also active, sworn peace officers. And part of that is doing supervision. COVID really put a lot of restrictions on that. But not only that, we lost a lot of staffing, and with that, we still have to have a training program to build them back up to make sure they're safe. So we're getting there. And we're going to be much more proactive. We do actively. So actually, last year I implemented one of my staff to go into the schools. So they're very proactive into the school environment. So we're trying to get it at that point. And it's not working with anybody that's on probation. It's just starting that preventative services. And it's working with these different schools all over the county.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Sure. Thank you. Because, you know, in my mind, we have a manageable number.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you mention LA, it's like they have an unmanageable number, right? And so I just, whatever we can do to keep us, as my favorite term, off the radar screen. So
appreciate
all, which is just really a testament to all the hard work you guys are putting into it. So I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
You doing all right, Wendy?
Yeah, let's take the next one and then take a break.
Well, I was going to try to get through a couple and then we'll get to the heavy hitter. I want to make sure you have a full half hour break before we get to it.
Good.
All right. All right, let's go on to the next item, 8C. FEMA trailers. Were those the six trailers that I got here for us?
Possibly.
I think they were.
We're going to make a profit, right?
Yeah, well, the customers are. We're not going to make it.
Good morning, Chair and Supervisors. I apologize. I just got my voice back, so it might be a little scratchy today.
It's okay.
So today, before you, there was a staff report, but our goal is that, my name is Brian Schoen, Siskiyou County Office of Emergency Services Director. I forgot that part. I was getting it.
Okay.
The lead up. So our goal, what we have done is we have the six FEMA trailers that we have, with HHS staff, recommended that we move those trailers to OES, which has been done. And then those trailers be sold to the Katy Fire survivors. As of right now, we have about five survivors that are suffering from homelessness. Most of the 187 structures that were lost, 87 of them were primary residents, and some of those residents have been unable to find stable housing. And this would be a direct push to those survivors who are suffering homelessness, living in their cars, living in various places, or couch surfing. And one of the things that we've really worked hard with the McKinney Fire Long-Term Recovery Group is to try to find stable housing for the folks that have been affected by the McKinney Fire. And when this option was brought forward, this was something that we really felt it could benefit those folks who, like I said, living in their cars, would give them a option outside of that. Most of the folks that are dealing with the homelessness do have a fixed income. So they have the means, they just don't have the means to either buy or relocate out of the area. And ultimately, the Klamath River is their home, and that corridor is what they want to continue to call their home. So this would allow them, working with Rick Dean and his staff, try to get those folks either back into their area or back into their property. One of the things that we work with, one of the things, those were six FEMA trailers that we did receive in 2020. Those have no longer been used, and they have not been used for a while. The housing need has not been filled to that area, so by pulling them from Cove and having them direct sell to the McKinney survivors is, like I said, is our primary goal with that. So Project Roomkey was that funding expired in 2021, which was what funded those FEMA trailers, so they're coming federally. Unlike the mill fire, these were brought to us through COVID through FEMA. The FEMA trailers that we're direct selling are different than the Cal OES trailers that were used for the mill fire. And in case, I feel like we've talked about this, but the mill fire survivors did receive the trailers. We were not able to secure trailer or housing for the McKinney fire survivors. So with that, pending your approval, would be as soon as we could get those trailers pushed in your approval, we would start the process of a matrix looking at their sheltering needs, where they're at, what they're doing, and how this really affects them and start building that stable housing and really require those basic needs that those folks in the McKinney Fire survivors have suffered from. So our goal would be to get them in as soon as possible, today being the 18th, looking at as soon as we can get each survivor with our disaster service coordinator tied in with Health and Human Services. We get those matrix built and have those folks really, hopefully, in some kind of sheltering within the next few weeks. So, pending any questions.
The first one I have is, are they going to get the family friend rate for the trailers?
Well, what is the family friend rate? We don't.
A dollar? I don't know.
So, yes, we would look at that with the matrix as well, okay. What their income is, what their needs are, and go from there, yes. Okay. And ideally, this is not a
county. We're trying to utilize trailers.
We utilize trailers to the best need possible.
All right, yes. I just want to make sure that this isn't a profit thing.
No, sir. No, thank you.
So
that was just time for us. I know a lot of that was done by us and General Services, so moved it from our trailer to the community, or from Cove to the county yard. That was just a Wednesday out of my day.
Well, I'm just saying if somebody purchases one and moves it down the river.
So the community has offered to help with that in the long-term recovery group. And as you know, that community is so tight, and they're like, this is fantastic, let us know, we'll move the trailers if need be. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And what's the life expectancy of one of these?
So the trailers are in really actually fairly good shape. They're actually really nice in that sense. There are a few minor little repairs that we were able to do once we got them all cleaned up.
They were new when we got them.
Yeah, brand new in 2020 when we got them. They've been lived in, but nothing, you know, they're actually really nice.
I'm assuming they're built better than an RV, I guess.
No, well, they are an RV. So there are multiple different RV brands and types. We got like a Whitehawk, a J-Flight. But yes, they're an RV.
That helps us. Well, thank you for that work. Doesn't begin to meet the housing need, but at least we're doing what we can.
Absolutely, and as we have said, this is a small portion of something that we can do. I highly encourage any of you to jump on the long-term recovery group for the McKinney Fire and see the still unmet needs and the many unmet needs that the McKinney Fire survivors are dealing with on a daily. And this is a small fraction of something that we can start to build that stability back into the Highway 96 corridor.
So is it?
And these are for residents?
Absolutely. So this is going to be based on necessity, not need, not necessity. So just not, hey, I'm on a trailer. Right. This is you are homeless, you had a house. This is
for you. Yes.
Perfect. Thank you.
So there's a question over?
No comments from me. Yeah. Supportive.
So are they working through Mr. Dean to get these trailers set up?
Well, our first goal was to get them moved. Second goal was to get them approved by our Board of Supervisors. Once that's done, then Rick Dean and I will have that conversation. But yes, that is our plan.
Okay, who'd like to make a motion?
Recommend the motion.
Second.
All righty. Supervisor Hall?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobson?
Aye.
Supervisor Chris?
Aye.
Supervisor Ogren? And Supervisor Valenzuela.
Yes. Okay, Wendy, I think this is a good time to take a break.
We can
get
do
yourself
that.
Ready. Get your ears ready for the next item. It'll be the big one for the day.